Nevertheless, if preachers don't tell the congregation, and if preachers themselves aren't aware of it, the consequences for people who are guilty of it, including the pastor himself, are rather dire. And so you should at least tell people. Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and down in verses 15 through 17, it talks about God's judgment. He's talking about his judgment seat. He said, if any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss. But he himself shall be saved, yet so as through or by fire. It pictures a man who has been judged. He has a glorified body. He's in heaven. But he has no rewards. Now, your work has to be based on Christ, and it has to be done in the right way, the proper manner, and with the right motivation. Being saved is easy. Serving God is not. When the Lord told the woman at the well, God is a spirit, and they that worship him must, that word's emphatic, they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. You can't just have a feeling or an emotion about God and do what the Pentecostals call pray through. It has to be done in spirit and in truth. And the Spirit of God is truth, and it has to be done his way. As I've pointed out many times, and it is something I'm extremely cognizant of, I am a sinner. I have bad thoughts. I have envy. I have jealousies. I get irritated. I am a man who is a sinner in the flesh. And I have an advocate with the Father, and when I'm guilty of these things, I ask God to forgive me. I can't live above sin. But I can worship God correctly. A lot of people call it legalism. But it's doing what God said, the way God said to do it. As Brent pointed out, these people in the Old Testament and in the New Testament were punished very severely, most severely, when they defiled something that pertained to the way that God wanted them to worship. The temple, the tent in the wilderness with the Ark of the Covenant and all the different utensils and different figures in that tent, the tabernacle in the wilderness, were all figures of the way God wanted to be worshipped. And you didn't tamper with those. If you did, God killed you. A lot of people don't realize this about the church. But believe me, the church is at least equally, more so, I think, important to God than anything else on this earth, or perhaps in any dispensation of time. And so when you are a member of one of the Lord's local churches, you're expected to do what Paul told Timothy to do. He said in 1 Timothy 3, 14 through 15, these things write I unto thee, hoping to come unto thee shortly, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth. Now I want you to notice what he had to say, writing to the church at Corinth, after he said, if any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved, yet so is by fire. Now there's nothing you can do that will ever cause your salvation to be taken away. But if you're a member of one of the Lord's churches, there is something that you can do that will cause God to destroy you in the flesh. He says, know ye not that ye are the temple of God? Now that's not talking about your body, because the plural is used for ye. He says, know ye not that you all are the temple of God? It's plural, so he can't be referring to an individual body. And that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you. The word that is used for in is ain. Like right now, I'm in you here, but I'm also among you. And the word with equal validity means among. And since the plural is used for ye, it means that he dwelleth among us. That's what the Bible teaches in Ephesians 2:22. It says, in whom ye also are builded together for habitation of God through the Spirit. So he says, know ye not that you all are the temple of God, and the Spirit of God dwelleth among you? If any man defile the temple of God, him shall God destroy. For the temple of God is holy, which temple ye are. Again, ye are is plural, himaeus. You all are. So he's talking about a church. Is there something I worry about more than anything else? Yeah. Is it the fact that I lust? Nope. Is it the fact that I sometimes stretch the truth? Nope. Is it the fact that sometimes I have sinful thoughts, I have jealousy thoughts, I'm envious, that I sometimes I get irritated, sometimes I get mad? Does that bother me? Oh yeah, that all bothers me. And I confess it. But there's one thing bothers me more than anything else. I do not want to be found guilty of changing or violating the way God said to worship. So when we talk about the Lord's Supper and the way we observe it, so many times people say, oh, they're just old hardcore legalists and they don't care anything about people and they don't love people. That isn't true at all. Because when you violate the Lord's Supper, that's the same thing as they did as violating the Ark of the Covenant. And it's an ordinance that was given to the church, and you must not violate it. And the ordinance of baptism, you must not violate it. So if I, as a man called of God and your pastor, decide that we can have a much larger church if we'll practice open communion, and I guarantee you we could, or if we would accept anybody's baptism, I guarantee you we'd have a much larger church. And if I just switch over and believe in believer's baptism like anybody that had been dunked, that's believer's baptism, they were a believer and they were dunked, so it has to be okay. If I said, yeah, that's fine, we can accept that, then I would be guilty of doing something that the Bible definitely teaches I shouldn't do, and that is a sin of arrogance. It is a sin, a knowledgeable sin, and God would kill me. I know he'd kill me. And that's one of the reasons God put it in there, because you see, in the flesh gets involved in everything you do. The flesh would like to see this whole church building full. The flesh would like for everybody in town to say, oh, that Brother Michael Murray is a wonderful man. Boy, he's a dynamic speaker, and that church is just jam-packed down there, and they're on fire for the Lord. My flesh would love to see that. But that's wrong, and God would kill me for it if I let my flesh override the way that we worship. You see, I can't live above sin. My flesh is going to influence me, and I'm going to yield at times. But I have an advocate with the Father, and when I confess that sin, it's over, it's finished, it's behind me. But this business of violating the way God said to worship, see, I can do that. I don't have to yield to that. And that's a willful and deliberate sin, and you better be careful. And so as a church member, I'm warning you all, you better be careful. And I, as your pastor, had better be careful. Now, Doc gave me something this morning that I really thought was appropriate. How do I feel about being your pastor? I've been here 26 years. How do I feel about it? Well, I couldn't have put it in better words than Doc brought me this morning in this article. This is the way I feel about it. There is no place like this place anywhere. Other pastors have said, yeah, they're a scriptural church. They're nice people. And Brother Michael Murray, he's all right. But they're different. Now, that's the common statement made about us. Am I offended by that? No, I'm not offended at all. I think it's wonderful. Because we are different. And there is no place like this place anywhere. And that's the truth. And anytime any pastor from any other church that has any comment to make about this church, if he knows anything about us, he's got two words that he says. They're different. Do I take offense at that? Is that derogatory? No, it's the truth. We are different. And there is no place like this place anywhere. My kids will tell you that. People that have been members here and gone to other churches, they'll tell you that. There's no place like this place anywhere. Well, how do I feel about being your pastor? Near this place. There is no place like this place anywhere near this place. Now, I'm sure there may be some other churches scattered around the world or in this country that are like us. I've seen a couple that were close. I think the church over at the Queen, where Joe Carlton pastors, is a lot like this church. But there's no place like this place anywhere near this place, in this vicinity. So how do I feel about you and about pastoring this church? You are the church. So this must be the place. There is no place just like this place anywhere near this place, so this must be the place. And I appreciate Doc bringing that in, because that was very appropriate and it was very apropos. Now, we've been talking about light refraction, and we've been talking about the tribulation period, and we've been talking about how you're going to have thousands and thousands of volcanic eruptions breaking out along all these tectonic plate boundaries, all along the cracks under the oceans and seas of the world and on land. And we've talked about how these cloud plumes that you see here on this diagram gradually and slowly would build up above the tropopause level in what we call the stratosphere. This is what happens every time there's a volcanic eruption, and since there's very little moisture up here, it's very hard for it to get out. And we've been talking about how the sun, moon, and stars would appear to a person if they were standing here on the earth and they were looking up. Part of the time, as these cloud plumes were forming around, you'd have breaks in between them, and part of the time you'd be able to see the sun, moon, and stars, and part of the time you wouldn't be able to see them. And that's exactly what we've been covering in Revelation in the 8th chapter and somewhere down around verse 5 or 6. Now, we've been talking about how gradually and slowly this cloud would build up. And as you can see here, eventually, by the end of the tribulation period, and remember we talked about when it started back in Revelation 6:12, and there was a great earthquake, and every mountain and isle were moved out of their places. And then we went to the last earthquake in the book of Revelation, that one I just quoted as the first, in Revelation 16:18. And there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. And by this time, at the end of the tribulation period, on the pouring out of the last vial, you will have a complete cloud shroud built all around the earth. Now, how will it happen? The Bible indicates that in Revelation 6:12, when the first great earthquake occurs and these tectonic plates really start to move, that the writing on this Hebrew scroll that you see on this screen, that clouds, the sun, moon, and stars, as you view them from the earth, will slowly disappear from view over a period of time, just like the writing on a scroll when you roll it together. As you slowly roll it together as you're reading, eventually this back part here completely unrolls and it comes together and you can't see the writing anymore. That means the writing has disappeared, which is what will happen at the end of the tribulation period. So at the end of the tribulation period, you're going to have a complete cloud shroud around the earth. You're not going to have pitch dark anywhere. On the other hand, you're not going to have clear light anywhere. Just like on a cloudy day, you've got sunlight out there. The last few days, we've had a lot of clouds, yet you could still drive around because you had light underneath the clouds. The thicker the cloud, the less light. You've still got light because of scattering, diffusion, refraction, reflection of the particles of sunlight as they come down through and reflect off the particles that we know as cloud particles. So you've still got some light. Now, there's an interesting thing about light. It's called the refraction of light. It's a law of light. It's something that is a law that God made. It's like God. It doesn't change. It's consistent. If you take a flashlight and you shine it down in water, the light from that flashlight goes straight toward the surface of the water. If you have it back at an angle, when the light hits the water surface, the law of refraction kicks into gear. It has to be bent. The light has to be bent. The law is, any time that light moves from a less dense medium, in this case, like air, into a more dense medium, like water, it is always bent or refracted like you see on this diagram. It's a principle. It's a law that God made. Now, we're going to take a look at where I stopped last week, and we're going to explain a scripture that has to do with the very last part of the tribulation period. Now, there's no question in my mind that this has to do with the coming of the Lord at the end of the tribulation period with all the saints that he has previously raptured out before this time, and now he's coming back with them to rule and reign for 1,000 years. Zechariah 14:4-5. And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west. And there shall be a very great valley, and half the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south. And ye shall flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach into Israel. Ye shall flee like as ye fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Now here we go. And the Lord my God shall come, and all the saints with thee. This is what's known as the second advent. The rapture has occurred before this, and here they come back to rule and reign. Now notice in verse 6. We're definitely at the end of the tribulation period. By this time, the cloud shroud has built up. Notice the effect on the light. Verse 6. And it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark. Now let's talk about what clear light is. The man who wrote this, Zechariah, was a Hebrew. If he had gone out on a beautiful sunny day where it was clear skies or just a few scattered puffy white clouds, and he had looked up toward the heaven, the light would have been flowing from the sun unrestricted on his body. And he would have said, thank you, Lord, for this beautiful, clear light. On the other hand, the opposite is dark. So you either have beautiful, clear, unrestricted light, or it's dark. What is dark? Dark is pitch dark. It means there's no light whatsoever. It means you're in a closed room, and there isn't any light at all, and it is pitch black dark. No light at all, like down in a deep cave. Well, we're told when the Lord comes back with all the saints, it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark. Now, I don't mean to sound facetious or arrogant or bold, but that can only be one thing and nothing else. It cannot be anything else except this, because it has to be on a worldwide basis. It means that all over the earth, you're going to have a cloudy day. So what do you have on a cloudy day? Well, for the last few days, you've had a lot of clouds. Sometimes it's been completely overcast. You've still been able to drive to work. You've still been able to come out and work in your yard. But you don't have light directly from the sun. It's not clear light. You've had clouds. On the other hand, it's not pitch dark like in a cave. It's in between. It said the light shall not be clear, completely unrestricted, nor shall it be dark. That's a cloudy day. I had one preacher tell me, Brother Michael Murray, that's too simple. It's not simple, because we had to run to and fro across the earth and experience a great increase in knowledge before we could understand what God wrote. God told Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. It's only simple because when I explain it, it makes it very understandable. But believe me, until we understood the laws of light, and until time passed and we could actually have run to and fro and man's knowledge could have been increased, God, who knew all things from the very beginning, wrote things that man could not possibly understand until God got ready for him to understand. Well, now you can understand it. It has to be a cloudy day all over the earth. Now, everything I've shown you, I've used Scripture. And I've shown you how the cloud shroud will build in. Now, this is the concrete proof of it. It has to be built in, because there has to be a cloud shroud built up. Now, there's an interesting thing about light, and it's this principle called refraction of light, and it's a law. See this light ray here? It travels right on. If this weren't water, we have air up here, water here, this would go right straight on down and come out at point P. It wouldn't be bent, but it's bent. Well, how does this apply to the Earth's atmosphere? Well, this cloud is more dense than the Earth's atmosphere. Now, let me explain a principle that works every day in the Earth's atmosphere. I've flown out to California hundreds of times because of all these lectures I do. I've flown all over the world. I spent most of my life flying to Alaska, to Hawaii, to the Philippines, to Japan, to England, to Lithuania, to Africa. And so I've certainly had a lot of time in airplanes. I can tell you something about flights that is indisputable, and it is based on the law of refraction. I took off one day from California, and I headed back toward Arkansas. Now, even though there weren't any clouds, as we took off, it was broad daylight, and we took off in the afternoon. We started flying back toward Arkansas. This has happened to me many times. All of a sudden, it got dark eventually at flight altitude, because the sun had disappeared over the horizon behind us. I mean, not at our altitude. It got dark on the ground. I'm sorry. It got dark on the ground. You see, the light, the curvature of the earth, the light was being cut off at the surface of the earth by the curvature of the earth, and it was dark on the ground. But up where I was at flight altitude, there was still plenty of light. It was broad daylight. If there had been a way I could have bent that light and refracted it back down to the earth in places like Lubbock, Texas, where they had all the lights on the earth, in the town, little specks of lights, you could see them. They could have turned those lights off and it would have had plenty of light if I could have bent what was at altitude. This isn't a theory. It's an absolute irrefutable fact. It's based on the refraction of light. I've already shown you how it works here, and it works that way with a glass of water. If you take just a principle of a glass of water, and you drop a pencil down in that water, then you stand back and look at the water, you will swear that pencil is broken. But it's not broken. Why does it appear to be broken? Because the light is traveling much faster in the air than it is in this glass, and it causes the glass to refract the water, the actual water to refract the light, and it makes the pencil look like it's broken at the waterline. There's a principle that applies all over the earth every day. It's called refraction of light, but it works everywhere. Here's a glass of water. Drop a coin in a glass of water, then stand back from the water, and you'll swear that the coin is up on the side of the glass, but it's not. It's down on the bottom. But you see, the light is traveling slower in the water because it's being refracted and bent than it is in the air, and it gives that apparent impression. Now, let me show you what will happen with that cloud shroud. And I had a man from Tennessee write me about this, and he thanked me for it. He was a physicist, had a doctor's degree in physics, And he taught, I believe, at the University of Tennessee, or he had worked on the Tennessee Valley Project. I'm 67 now, and I get mixed up. But in any case, here's the sun. And the sun comes up like this, and every day it passes into our atmosphere. You can see the earth here. You can see our atmosphere. Now, the sunlight would go right across and go straight on through if our atmosphere was not denser than the outer space. In outer space, it's not refracted because of the density. It's practically a vacuum, practically. The light would go straight on through here if our Earth's atmosphere wasn't there. But some of it still does go on through, but a lot of it gets refracted around the Earth, such that by process of the law of refraction and the law of scattering, here's the sun on the opposite side of the Earth. Let's say right here is Dardanelle. The sun's shining straight down on Dardanelle, and if there are no clouds, it's a beautiful sunny day. But even on a beautiful sunny day, if there aren't any clouds around here, there's some degree of refraction. And so you can see how the light has been around here on the opposite side of the Earth. Let's say China is there. Well, over there on the opposite side, some of the sunlight would be coming over here. Now, what I've shown you is really based, there's some degree of refraction, but it's not nearly as great as if there were a cloud, because the refraction is based on the density of the object it passes through. If there were a cloud, it would not pass through the Earth's atmosphere and go back out into outer space. Here's the Earth. Here's our atmosphere around it. The sun would shine into the cloud, and instead of going on back out into space, passing through the periphery of the Earth's atmosphere, it would be bent around the Earth and would come over here on the opposite side of the Earth in China. Now, what would it be like right down here at Dardanelle? Well, you notice I've got the cloud shroud built in around the Earth. We would have light here. How much light would we have? Well, the light wouldn't be clear. It wouldn't be like a beautiful sunny day. But since the sun is shining directly on top of this, and there's no refraction, it's just a direct impact, then I would say here it would be like a very cloudy day that we would have here, like we've had the last several days. But what about on the other side of the Earth? Would you have as much light there, where it's being refracted around on the opposite side of the Earth? No, you wouldn't have as much light as you'd have here. How much light would you have? You'd have some light. You say, well, what if that cloud wasn't there? On the other side of the Earth, it would be pitch dark. Because if the cloud wasn't there, then the sunlight at night, which is over here shining on Dardanelle, would not go, it would go back out into space and wouldn't be refracted over here. So you wouldn't have any light at all. It would be pitch dark. So what I'm saying is, according to the laws that the same God who wrote these prophecies made, the law of refraction, the law of scattering, that when this cloud is built in, you're going to have a unique situation. You're going to have light all over the Earth. Even at midnight, in some places, you'll have light where normally you wouldn't have light because the cloud is built in. But nowhere on the Earth will the light be perfectly clear, nor will it be pitch dark, which is exactly what the Bible indicated. Now, we're going to take a look at the conclusions I came to and why I came to them. Now, this article came out many years after I started this lecture series. I started doing this in 1978. And when this article came out, it was a great help to me, and a lot of people began to say, well, you know, maybe he knows what he's talking about. The space mirror. Unmanned spacecraft progress. Plastic mirror. Let there be light. Here's what the Russians did. They took on the opposite side of the Earth the sunlight, which was coming in from the other side of the Earth, and they put a satellite up to where the light beam would come down on the Earth and refract it, just like if it were a cloud, even more effective. Let there be light. A Russian space mirror brings a little sunshine to the night. It wasn't nearly enough to make crops grow or give anyone a Santa Tropez tan, but for the first time ever, there was sunlight in the middle of the night. Sunlight at night. This seemingly divine miracle was actually the product of a thin 65-foot plastic mirror mounted on the unmanned Russian spacecraft Progress, which from its 225-mile-high perch reflected light on a sleeping Europe. Now, this shows it wasn't a frivolous attempt, and it actually happened, and they performed it. So what I'm showing you is not a theory. It's not something that wouldn't work. It's something that has worked quite frequently. Now, why am I so sure what I've shown you is true? I had two scriptures that I knew were given for some reason. And there had to be a reason. And there had to be a way God intended to do it. Now, God could have done it miraculously and broken all of his laws and all of his rules. And sometimes God does that. Like when you turn water into wine, he broke every rule in the book. That doesn't fit anything that man knows. It's impossible. Yet God did it. He set aside his own laws of nature. However, in some cases, God works within the framework of his own miraculous power and the creation that he made. That's what he's going to do in this case. Notice, and it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark. Nowhere on the earth is it going to be perfectly sunny, and nowhere is it going to be pitch dark. Now look at verse 7. But it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night, a cloudy day. But it shall come to pass, and this is the clincher, that at evening time it shall be light. Do you know we have missionary Baptist preachers that think that's heresy? Do you know we have missionary Baptist preachers that are highly critical of that? Why in heaven's name would they be critical of that, when it merely confirms everything that God put in the Word? I have great difficulty in understanding some missionary Baptist preachers. I don't have a lot of problem in understanding missionary Baptist church members, because they're just like me, hard-headed, mulish, and stubborn. But why preachers would fight against this is beyond my comprehension. When everything that I present is out in the open, it's public, it's nothing that's done sleight of hand, and every single thing that I've ever taught on this can be fully validated if you'll check out the different principles. Furthermore, everything that God has done in the earth in the past has confirmed this. Do volcanoes influence weather? Again, the 1883 eruption of Krakatoa in the same area gave rise to astonishing atmospheric effects over a large part of the earth for more than a year. In Europe, a strange light illuminated the night sky so that one could read a newspaper at midnight. This was caused by the diffusion of solar light by fine particles of ash in suspension at high altitude. So I have shown you a lot of different things about the Lord, about this particular effect, and how it will affect light all over the earth. Now, next Sunday, Lord willing, I'm going to talk about when the Lord comes back, because there's something that has always bugged me as a child. The Bible clearly states that when Jesus returns at the end, every eye shall see him. How is that possible? Well, some preachers say to me, well, Brother Mark, you don't have to worry about things. God will take care of things like that. Well, I think God already has in his word. And I think if you study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, right and dividing the word of truth, you're trying to find out the truth of God, and you're curious about what God has to say. If you're not, you can believe anything you want. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. When you talk to me about diligently seeking God, you're talking about trying to figure out what he does. So when I was a boy, and it talked about every eye seeing him, I figured, well, is he going to be like Superman and fly around the earth where everybody sees him, you know, come down and go through this cloud and around? No, he isn't going to do that at all. Every eye is going to see him simultaneously at exactly the same time. And it all has to do with what I've shown you about that cloud. If this all didn't fit together like a glove, I wouldn't believe it. But it fits together just like a glove. God said it. I believe it. And I think I know how he's going to do it. You say, well, Brother McMurray, suppose the Lord comes back and he does it in an entirely different way. Do you think he's going to jump all over you at the judgment seat of Christ? No. But I think he's going to jump over on those people that didn't have any interest at all in it and weren't even curious about it, never even made an effort to find out. I think the ones that weren't interested in God's word are the ones that are in trouble, not the ones who have a curiosity about it. I think there are lots of things that involve the tribulation period and prophecy that God is going to be a lot more pleased if you were interested in it and tried to understand it and made the wrong interpretation than if you never made the effort at all. That's why I don't get all upset at somebody that doesn't agree with me on something. I don't understand some of it. In some areas I can understand why, because there's lots of things I'm not all that sure of. But I think it's the effort that's important. And so I'll close with that, and we'll begin with the coming of Christ and how every eye shall see him, and we'll do that, Lord willing, next Sunday morning.